to that man behind the curtain.
All that hate's gonna burn you up, kid.
Keeps me warm.
You'll put down your rock and I'll put down my sword and try and kill each other like civilized people.
The Red 7 MovieCast, the official podcast of the Rage Cinema. This is episode 11 for Monday, February 19th, 2018. I'm your host, Manth Naidu, and you can follow me on Twitter and on Letterboxd at HJ Naidu. That's H-J-N-A-I-D-U. So last week, we got to get our first look at the upcoming Cobra Kai web series that's going to be released on YouTube Red. So we hadn't heard a lot about this since it was first announced. I think it was announced maybe a couple of years ago. And I was pretty excited to hear that they were making this series. So I'm a pretty big fan of The Karate Kid. I've been a fan for a very long time, since it was released, or a few years after it was released anyway. I actually have an All Valley Under 18 Karate Championship referee t-shirt and a Cobra Kai t-shirt that I continue to wear today. And so yeah, that was pretty exciting news to find out that they're going to be making this new web series. So the original Karate Kid, I actually saw this a few years later than after it was released. Not that because I didn't have the chance to see it, but it was just a funny little bit of story here. So I wanted to buy this toy. They were called Stompers back in the 80s, and they were basically just these little toy trucks that took a battery, and then you'd turn it on, it'd move on its own. They weren't that big. They were just, you know, bigger than a Hot Wheels car, but I don't know what was so special about them. They were kind of just the hot thing at the time, and I really wanted this one that was in this store in my hometown. So I didn't have any money to buy it, so I got my mom to give me an advance on my allowance that I was getting, and I used that money to buy the Stomper, and yay, that was cool. But then that weekend was when The Karate Kid was playing in the theater in my hometown, and I didn't have any money to go see it, so I was trying to get my mom to, you know, give me the money to go see it, and I think this is the only time ever that my mom didn't actually cave in and just, you know, let me have my way. She said, no, you wanted that advance on your allowance to buy that toy, and you have to live with your decision. So all my friends went, and after seeing it, they all loved it, and I just was hating my life at that point. So, you know, I was kind of sad about it for a little while, but then I just forgot about it, and, you know, never really thought about it again. And then one of my best friends, every summer he used to go to Winnipeg and visit his family there, and I think his family had HBO or something like that, and he would always come back, you know, with this box of VHS tapes that he had taped movies off HBO, and one of them was Karate Kid. And I said, hey, let's watch that. And he was really surprised when I told him I hadn't seen it. He forgot that I didn't go with him when they went to it in the theater. So anyway, we watched it, and I just loved it. And I think I've probably seen the original Karate Kid, I'm not kidding, like over 100 times. I really like it. And even the sequels, I liked the sequels, even though, you know, they weren't as good. Karate Kid 2 was decent. I think it was a little bit more, I think the critics tended to like that one as well. And then Karate Kid 3 was a disaster critically, but I still liked it. I was at the age of, can't remember the exact year that came out. I think I was in grade 8 or 9 or something. So I was kind of at the age maybe where that, you know, all the badness didn't really matter to me. I had fun with it and I really liked it. And then the next Karate Kid, I saw that when I was in university, and that one had Hilary Swank in it and Pat Morita, but I really didn't like that. It was pretty terrible. And then many years later, the new Jaden Smith remake came out with Jackie Chan, and I actually quite enjoyed that. I thought they did a pretty good job of that. So yeah, I'm a big Karate Kid fan. So when that trailer dropped this past week, I was pretty excited to watch it and checked it out. And, you know, it doesn't really reveal too much. It's, I can't remember if they said it was a trailer or a teaser, but it was more of a teaser. There's just basically this voiceover of Johnny Lawrence, who was the main bad guy in the original Karate Kid. And he's just talking about bringing back the Cobra Kai dojo And he's saying, you know, famous lines like, "We don't train to be merciful here. Mercy is for the weak." And it's strike first, strike hard. No mercy, sir. And he's just talking about, you know, starting up the dojo again. And in the final shot, we see Johnny Lawrence and Daniel LaRusso face to face in the dojo. And basically, that's all the trailer is. So, yeah, we don't get a lot out of it, but, you know, it was enough there to get me excited again for it, because we hadn't heard anything about this since they first announced it, you know, like a couple of years ago. So really excited to still see it. And it's, you know, I remember them actually also saying that this was going to be a comedy. I'm pretty sure I remember them saying that this web series is going to be a comedy when they announced it. But from the trailer, there was nothing there that made it look like it was going to be a comedy. It looks like it's going to be a serious show, and I'd much rather that they go down that route of keeping it, you know, semi-serious and just along the same tone as the original films. I think that would be much better. I mean, obviously they all had comedy in it, but I don't want a straight comedy. I'd like it to, you know, stick with that same tone that we're used to for all the Karate Kid movies. So this is going to be a YouTube Red series, meaning that it's going to be subscription only to that Red service. So I don't have one right now, but I'll definitely sign up for it, you know, in the least just to watch the series. And I don't know how many episodes it's going to be or how long it's going to run, but I guess it's working if, you know, that they're putting stuff out there that, you know, some people are going to want here and there and, you know, get the subscription. So, yeah, looking forward to that. And I will put a link to the trailer in the show notes if you haven't seen it yet. I recommend checking it out. So this week I'll be talking about three films that I watched. The Ritual, released in 2017. Fast Times at Ridgemont High, released in 1982, and Black Panther, which was just released last weekend, 2018. Here's a clip from the trailer for The Ritual.
Rob would have loved this place. He's a good man. The best of us.
You know, they have walking trails in England. Pubs.
Come on, man, where's your soul?
It's twisted.
All right, yep.
Easy.
Look, we go southwest through here. We cut the journey in half.
What, through the forest?
Yeah, why not?
I should have gone to Vegas.
Oh, you'd have found something to fall over in Vegas too, mate.
Now, is it me, or is it really quiet in here?
It's been gutted.
Could be hunters out here.
Bait,
possibly. Or it's the bit they don't show you in the nature documentary.
It's a warning.
We shouldn't be here.
Where the hell are we, Hutch?
We should pitch the tent.
This is ridiculous, man.
Luke, you're getting soaked.
Did you hear that?
No, I didn't hear anything. Come on.
The Ritual is directed by David Bruckner, written by Joe Barton and Adam Neville, starring Rafe Spall, Arshar Ali, and Robert James Collier. The description is, a group of college friends reunite for a trip to the forest, but encounter a menacing presence in the woods that's stalking them. So I watched this on Netflix in my theater. This is a Netflix film, and I didn't really hear anything about it up until a point, probably a couple weeks ago, it started showing up in some of my news feeds and people were talking about it a little bit. So I didn't read anything about it, but I decided that I definitely wanted to check it out. So this one actually reminded me a lot of another British horror film. So this is a British movie. And the one it reminds me of is 2005's The Descent. So there's a similar theme in both movies. It's a group of friends going on an adventure following a tragedy that happened to their group. And we see both main characters throughout the film struggling with this guilt that they have from when that tragedy happened. So I really liked this film, The Ritual. But it didn't really get to the level of The Descent, I don't think. I think The Descent is definitely one of my favorite horror films of all time, and so it was a lot to live up to, but it definitely had the same feeling as that movie, and that definitely played well with me. So this movie has a lot of great cinematography. So it's set in, I think they head to Switzerland to do this trek, and they just want to climb this mountain. It's a well-known trail, so they want to go through there and, you know, get to the top and do a little bit of a ceremony for their friend that they had lost at the beginning of the movie. And so the cinematography here is really nice, just in this mountainous landscape. And then eventually, as the movie goes on, they move into the forest, and there's just a lot of really cool shots in the forest, just the way that it shows, you know, the denseness of the trees and everything going on in the forest. So lots of really nice cinematography here. So the first two acts of this film, they create a really good sense of mystery and unease. And then eventually, you know, everything gets really terrifying and horrific. But it's done using the less is more approach. There's something out there, and we don't know if it's real or not. We only get brief glimpses of it, and they're not really telegraphed glimpses. They kind of just happen out of nowhere, so you don't really catch it yourself as a viewer unless you, you know, pause it and rewind it. But I thought that was really done nicely. And there's definitely a lot of creepy scenes in this that just make your skin crawl. There's this one scene where they've come across this abandoned cabin in the forest that they're in, and they all decide to stay there for the night because it starts to rain, and, you know, they, rather than setting up tents and getting all extra wet, may as well just stay in this old cabin. And yeah, so whatever, they go to sleep, and then middle of the night, I guess, everyone wakes up, and there's nothing in there with them. It's just something happened. I guess maybe they had some dreams or some sort of experience, but there's this one scene, there's this one guy, he's upstairs, and he's kind of in this weird pose, and he's kind of like in this praying and worshiping pose, and it's just the way it's lit and just the way that it's shot, it's super creepy. And it's lots of stuff like that in this, and I think the film does lots of great stuff with that. The acting was pretty good. So this is a group of guys that are all, you know, good buddies from college. So I think the film does a really nice job of just capturing the banter between good friends. It seems realistic, you know, lots of stuff that, you know, these old friends would talk about. And then once they, you know, get into the meat of the story and we get into the horror elements of the show, the terror that they feel, I think, and that the way they portray it, I think it's really realistic, and it's just not over the top. And I think it's hard to, you know, say how people would react in this situation, but it seems like this is probably how people would react in the situation that they're in. So the film's main focus is on this one character who, he didn't really play a part in the tragedy at the beginning of the film where they lost one of their buddies, but he was there when it happened, and he feels guilty because he didn't really help when maybe he had the chance to help his friend. But so the film explores his guilt, and throughout the film, that opening scene of him and his friend, where the tragedy happens, keeps playing out, you know, in the forest where they are. But it's, you know, it's kind of a mix of this forest and this liquor store where it went down. And the film does a good job of continuing to show us that. And the way that the film ends and the resolution, I think it's really good. There is a little bit of ambiguity to it, and I'm wondering if it's possible to read into it a little bit. We saw this in The Descent, actually, too. It was, the way it ended was a little bit ambiguous, and there were a couple different ways to interpret it, and they were quite different ways of interpreting it. I think that can be seen here as well. Like, did what everything we just saw in this movie actually happen the way we saw it? Or was this, you know, the main character, were they actually, you know, the cause of everything we saw in this movie? So I think that ending is really cool here, and I think that really, you know, can get the discussion going on how you read it. So lots of good stuff in this movie. There's definitely some stuff that I didn't care for. So like I said, the first two acts were really strong, just building up that tension and just keeping this creepy and uneasy feeling for the film. But once we get into the third act, I think they make the mistake of just showing way too much and taking the mystery away of what was built up in those first two acts. So there is something in the forest with them, or that's what we're led to believe, you know, in the first two acts. But by the third act, it's shown to us that there's this beast or whatever out in the forest that's, you know, stalking them and trying to get them. And I would have preferred that monster, or the idea of the monster, were just left ambiguous and not really, you know, just put out there and saying this is what it is. And then also in the third act, we're introduced to this village where there are these people living, and I don't know what they are. They're like, they seem like they might be witches or something like that, but they are worshiping this beast that's out in the forest. And I really think that this group really wasn't really needed in the movie. I don't really think it added too much. I wish they would have left that mystery of what was going on. And by introducing these people and showing the beast, I mean, like I said, that mystery is gone. So there was a few interesting things with this group of people. Like, they were suggesting that all these people in this village were there and they were all dealing with guilt or something. They were all dealing with something similar to how the main character was dealing with something, and that's why he was brought to them. So, you know, that was kind of cool, and, you know, you can maybe see that maybe these people were there and, you know, they were either going to give in to their guilt or let it consume them. And I think, you know, that was maybe what was going on with, you know, how they were worshiping this beast. They choose not to really confront it, but they're just going to like live with it and let it consume them. So that was interesting. But like I said, I don't think it was really necessary. And I think it kind of took away from the film to include this group of people in there. And then the theme of this film was a little bit too on the nose, I think. So the director made sure that everyone knew that the experience represents the guilt being felt by the main character. Like, everything that's going on is just so tied into his guilt. And it's like I said, it's pretty on the nose. So I think this could have been a little bit more subtle. I don't think it had to be so obvious. Like, The Descent had a similar thing, but it wasn't, you know, in your face. It was there, but it was something you had to think about or realize was going on. And this one is just like right there in your face. So I think they could have toned that back a bit and made it a little bit stronger as a movie. So even though, also, you know, the characters, like I said, the reactions and the way they were dealing with things seemed realistic for the most part. But then there comes a point where they're just not taking what's happening to them seriously. I don't mean they're not taking it seriously as they're joking about it. I mean that there's all this stuff happening and they're just not accepting that this stuff is happening and that it's real. And that seemed a little bit far-fetched, you know, as it went on. It was like, are these guys dumb? Like, this is happening and they're continuing to argue about whether this is real. You know, should we keep continuing down this path through the forest? And I mean, it seems like at some point they would have turned around with all this crazy stuff happening, but they just continuing through the forest. So I guess, you know, the script needed them just to keep going down the forest. So they did. And their motivations for doing that, I mean, yeah, they're trying to get out of the forest because they're lost, but I think their motivations weren't really well established enough for have them continue on this path. And yeah, I think it was just the script needed them to go in that forest and to keep going. So that's just what happened. A few things I didn't like about it, you know, but other than that, I still really enjoyed this film. I had a really good time with it. Tons of creepy moments, and it did not rely on lots of blood and gore or anything to, you know, shock or scare you. Like, jump scares, there's a few jump scares I think here and there, but that's not what, you know, defines this movie. So the first two acts are very strong, and it falters a bit in the third as they remove some of the mystery, but still extremely fun and definitely worth a watch. My rating for The Ritual is 4 out of 5.
Am I hallucinating here? Just what in the hell do you think you're doing?
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Mr. Spicoli, you're on dangerous ground here. You're causing a major disturbance on my time.
I've been thinking about this, Mr. Hand. If I'm here and you're here, doesn't that make it our time? Certainly there's nothing wrong with a little feast on our time.
You're absolutely right, Mr. Spicoli. It is our time. Yours, mine, and everyone else's in this room. But it is my class. Hamilton, Brandt, Kornfeld, up front.
Mr. Spicoli has been kind enough to bring us a snack. Be my guest. Help yourselves. Get a good one.
That was a clip from the trailer for Fast Times at Ridgemont High, released in 1982. Directed by Amy Heckerling, written by Cameron Crowe, starring Sean Penn, Jennifer Jason Leigh, Judge Reinhold, and Phoebe Cates. Description is, follows a group of high school students growing up in Southern California based on the real-life adventures chronicled by Cameron Crowe, Stacey Hamilton and Mark Ratner are looking for a love interest and are helped along by their classmates, Linda Barrett and Mike Damone, respectively. The center of the film is held by Jeff Spicoli, a perpetually stoned surfer dude who faces off with the resolute Mr. Hand, who is convinced that everyone is on dope. So this was film number 7 on my 52 Films Directed by Women project. I watched it in my theater and rented it on iTunes. So I didn't actually realize, but Amy Heckerling is also the director of Clueless. So she directed Clueless 13 years after Fast Times at Ridgemont High. And Clueless is definitely one of my favorite high school films of all time. Really like that movie. And, you know, I don't go out of my way to watch it or rewatch it, but when I come across it on TV or on some movie channel, I typically will stop and watch it. So a funny little piece of trivia about Fast Times at Ridgemont High is Universal's first choice to actually direct this was David Lynch. So it's just, can you imagine what this film would have been like if David Lynch had directed it? But apparently he turned it down pretty quickly, just stating that it was way too far outside his wheelhouse. And, you know, he said good luck with it. And that was that. But that was a pretty interesting piece of trivia. So even though everyone's heard of Fast Times at Ridgemont High, it didn't actually do well during its theatrical release. It was actually considered a bomb. And once it got to VHS and people started to get the word of mouth out about Sean Penn's character Spicoli and his performance, and that character actually started to, you know, build up some momentum, and with it out on VHS, it actually started to create a bit of a following, and that's kind of where it took hold, was in its home release. So I wasn't sure if I'd actually ever seen this movie before. I definitely thought I had seen bits and pieces here and there over the years, but then when I actually watched it, none of it really rang a bell with me, and so I guess I never did see it. So that was actually surprising to me. So this film opens up with a montage that really captures the 80s. We see arcades and malls and just the music that's playing. I think it's the Go-Go's, We Got the Beat. So it really, you know, sets up that 80s feeling, and, you know, this movie has a great soundtrack, all this great 80s music, and I'm a pretty big 80s music fan. I mean, I was growing up during the 80s. I was born in 75, so I was, you know, a young kid in the 80s. So all that music resonates with me, and it, you know, brings back that nostalgia. So it's always fun to see that stuff, or to hear that stuff, I guess. And then there's a lot of these well-known actors in this film that are kids, so it's pretty cool to see them, because, you know, you see them now and you don't really think of them playing these roles as kids, so it was pretty cool. So this movie's over 35 years old, and it actually holds up pretty well. A lot of the comedy from that time period could be a bit cringeworthy today. Like, you'll watch a lot of comedies from the, you know, 80s and even the early 90s, and there's lots of, you know, homophobic type jokes, for instance, or, you know, gender type jokes. And this film actually was lacking most of that. There was a, you know, the odd thing here and there. I think they pinned a sign to one guy's back with a certain message on it. And, you know, I think that was the most of it. And I was actually pretty surprised that, you know, this film is actually fairly light on that stuff, which was pretty cool to see. The comedy as well, it holds up pretty good for being that old. And that's usually the sign of a pretty good film. I often think about, you know, a lot of the classic 80s TV comedies. You can really tell if which ones have held up and which ones are good when you rewatch them today. And I actually recently watched the series Cheers. I don't think I watched it all, but I watched quite a bit of it on, I think it was on Netflix or Crave TV or something. But that show is just as funny today as it was in the 80s. And, you know, that's how you know quality, if it can hold up over the years and still, you know, still hit on the comedy. That's pretty good. And this movie, for the most part, it did that as well. So this is a typical high school film, and it's obviously influenced the genre up until today and continuing to influence it. You can see a lot of that. So Dazed and Confused was the first one that came to mind. Very similar feel to Fast Times. And then Everybody Wants Some as well. I mean, that one was a college, it's set in college with college kids, but it definitely had a similar vibe. And it's interesting that actually both those movies are Richard Linklater movies. But yeah, they definitely felt a lot like that. And I think every teen movie you watch today is going to probably have something that they got from Fast Times. think it does, you know, a really good job of just capturing the teen experience. I think it's really successful at that. Just the actions and decisions being made and basing them on basically nothing. They, you know, they're making all these huge decisions and they have really no experience to back up any these decisions. They're doing them without regard for the future. And, you know, I think one of the themes is just, you know, the ignorance that comes with being a teenager. And I think it does a really good job of just capturing that in this film. The stories in this film, I mean, we're following a few different groups of friends and a few different characters, but I like the simplicity of the story and their stories. Teen comedies today, they tend to, you know, try and make everything over the top. Every little piece of the film is, you know, something crazy happens. So, for instance, there's a scene in this film where one of the characters, Rat, is on a date with Jennifer Jason Leigh's character, and he forgets his wallet. So in a comedy, I'm thinking today, you know, we would have seen a whole bit out of this. They would have probably stretched this scenario out to make it some crazy, crazy thing. But this film just, you know, they have his buddy, Mike Damone, bring him his wallet after he calls him on the phone. And basically that's it. And the scene, I mean, the scene's there to mostly, you know, they're showing a spark between Damone and Jennifer Jason Leigh's character, Stacy. But I could just see that scene today where Rat sneaks away into the bathroom and, you know, tries to get a window open and Damone's trying to get him the wallet and it falls in the toilet or, you know, something stupid like that. But this movie just kind of plays it straight and, you know, that's refreshing. And then there's a little bit of a side story with a pregnancy and an abortion. And I think they handle it quite well here as well. I think a lot of movies at this point, if this were to happen in a movie today, that would have just taken over the film. So in this film, the scenario comes up and, you know, it plays out and resolves itself. But I think it's done realistically. It seems like it plays out realistically. And it does lead to a pretty great moment. You know, it's a subtle moment, but it's between Jennifer Jason Leigh and Judge Reinhold's characters. So they're brother and sister, and there's just this nice little moment that happens at the end of this particular part of the story. And it's actually not, it was surprising. I didn't think, you know, a movie like that would have something like that in here, but it worked out nice. And then the big draw to this film is definitely Sean Penn as the stoner Spicoli. He is pretty great. You know, maybe it's a little bit over the top here and there, but it's definitely very entertaining, and he's pretty good in the role. And it actually, as I was watching it, it really reminded me of Keanu Reeves in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. So basically the voice sounds exactly the same, and just the way he's speaking, even though Ted isn't a, you know, a stoner surfer dude in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, but the voice and just the mannerisms of him are very similar. So I was wondering if Keanu based his performance on the Spicoli character. I tried Googling it to find out, but there's not much about it. There was a few stories about people definitely finding the performance similar, but there was nothing that said that Keanu, you know, based head on that, on Spicoli. So despite all this, you know, this really good stuff in the film here, there are definitely some problems I had with it. There's no real story or plot to this movie. It just follows a bunch of different characters, you know, who don't really have any connection other than them going to the same school. And, you know, their stories don't really cross paths at any point, and it doesn't really come to a, you know, all come to a head at the end. It's just kind of these separate stories that just kind of happen. So it's just kind of like a snapshot of something happening in the school or around these kids that go to the school. So that was definitely one of the weaker points for me. And then also, I feel really uncomfortable in films where they have nude scenes with, you know, people that are supposed to be in high school. So Phoebe Cates and Jennifer Jason Leigh in particular here. I mean, I think they were, I looked at their ages of when they filmed this, and I think they were 19 and 20 respectively when the film was made. But I think they're playing, like, I know Jennifer Jason Leigh is definitely playing a 15-year-old, and I think Phoebe Cates' character is, supposed to be a little bit older, so whatever, 16, 17. But still, it seems weird that, you know, they have these nude scenes with these apparent children in it. So that always feel funny about that, and it turns me off a little bit. And that's definitely a thing in the 80s movies. Like, I remember 16 Candles, similar thing. There's that shower scene in that. Was it maybe not 16 Candles? Maybe that might have been Weird Science. One of them, anyway. It seems to always have been happening in the 80s movies. So we don't see that anymore today, and I'm definitely okay with that. And then the ending of this movie, it's pretty weak. There's no real resolution to anything. It just kind of like ends out of nowhere. And I guess that makes sense, because I mean, the story, or I guess the movie itself, like I said, doesn't have much of a story or plot. So there's really nowhere to end this thing. So I mean, some of the characters definitely have an arc, but it just didn't seem that it tied up nicely. So that was definitely disappointing for me. So this movie as a whole, I mean, it is a classic, and because of that, I definitely recommend checking it out. It's a solid teen movie that's, you know, it's set the bar for all teen movies after it, and probably to come much into the future. My rating for Fast Times at Ridgemont High is 3.5 out of 5. So the third movie I watched was 2018's Black Panther. Here's a clip from the trailer.
I have seen gods fly. I've seen men build weapons that I couldn't even imagine.
Uh-huh.
I've seen aliens drop from the sky.
Yeah.
But I have never seen anything like this. How much more are you hiding?
Hola. Let's go. Go. Go.
We are home. My son, it is your time.
Show me my respect and bow down.
You get to decide what kind of king you are going to be. Don't freeze.
I never freeze.
Black Panther is directed by Ryan Coogler, written by Ryan Coogler and Joe Robert Cole, starring Chadwick Boseman, Michael B. Jordan, and Lupita Nyong'o. The description is: T'Challa, the new ruler of the advanced kingdom of Wakanda, must defend his land from being torn apart by enemies from outside and inside the country. I watched this at the Cineplex VIP theater in 3D with my wife. So I planned on seeing this movie in the theater since they first announced it. Part of my rules for, you know, allowing myself to go to a public theater and not wait for the Blu-ray release or streaming is, you know, it has to be a movie I obviously really want to see, or I guess it has to be a movie that I want to support for some reason. And this movie I wanted to support just because of, you know, what it was doing and what it was trying to say, and, you know, trying to, you know, put my money into something where we're getting this. We're starting to see a little bit more representation out there in films, and this is something I wanted to, you know, make sure I put my money into. So I pre-bought tickets about a month ago, I think, for the opening weekend, and I picked Saturday night so my wife and I could have a date night, which is something we don't get to do too often. So I made two mistakes on the planning of this, and I guess a little bit on the execution as well, but so part of the execution part where I had a mistake was, so whenever we get a chance to go out, just my wife and I, to dinner, we usually, most of the time, we go back to the same place. It's our favorite restaurant in the city here. And every time I go, I need to order, as a starter, the wings that they have on the menu. So these are these Thai wings that are, I don't know, I just love them. They're so delicious. And whenever I go to the restaurant, I just, you know, I feel it would be a crime not to order them and, you know, give myself that experience of the delicious wings. And so I order the wings, and I also always order a full entree, and that's always a mistake. It always proves to be way too much food for me, and I can never finish the main course, and then I feel uncomfortable, and it's, you know, that uncomfortable full feeling for the, you know, the rest of the night, and I hate that. So now every time I do this, I say I will never do it again, and then the next time comes, and then guess what? I do it. No different this time. I actually came really close not to doing it. I actually placed my order for my main course. My wife ordered a main course, plus she ordered an appetizer as well. And then at the last second, I said, throw on those wings as well. And there we go. So, same thing happened. Ate the wings. I was full. That would have probably been good enough for a meal for me. And then my main course came out. Couldn't eat it all. Ate maybe 2/3 of it. Had to force myself and had that uncomfortable fullness feeling basically for the rest of the night. And like I said, I hate that. So I don't know, maybe I need to give the kitchen a photo of me to put up there with a little note under it that says, do not let this guy order the wings in a main course because he will regret it. And then, so I said two mistakes I made. The other mistake was I didn't realize that the Black Panther release weekend was also the weekend for the NBA All-Star game and all the NBA All-Star weekend festivities. And the best part of, for me anyway, of the NBA All-Star weekend is the All-Star Saturday night. So that's where, you know, they have the three-point contest and the dunk contest and the skills challenge. And that's, for me, and I think for most people, that's the most entertaining piece of the weekend. So our tickets were for Saturday night, and that obviously meant I couldn't watch All-Star Saturday night, so I had to PVR it, and which is fine. I just watched it the next day with my kid, but you don't get to follow along, you know, with the social media and just kind of get caught up in all that fun, but whatever, that was okay. And then actually when I was watching it, there was actually a Black Panther and All-Star Saturday night connection. So during the slam dunk contest, one of the contestants, Victor Oladipo from the Indiana Pacers, I think during his second dunk, he went over to the sidelines and Chadwick Boseman was sitting there. And so Chadwick Boseman gave Oladipo a Black Panther mask, which he then put on and proceeded to do his second dunk wearing that Black Panther mask. So it was pretty cool. Cool idea. There was all that little extra bits for show always help with the slam dunk contest. But yeah, the dunk, it was okay. It was nothing spectacular, but it was definitely a cool little thing, especially for, you know, Black Panther opening weekend. So getting into the actual movie here. So the movie, first thing off the bat was it looked really good, especially Wakanda. So it's this high-tech city that just, you know, has a futuristic look to it. But the thing with it is that everything, you know, had a distinctly African look to it. So I've never seen anything like that before, I don't think. It was just, you know, it's really unique. Just this very modern, very high-tech city that looked, you know, like it belonged in Africa. So that was really, really cool part of it. Yeah, it's just really cool when they're flying, you know, from outside Wakanda. So Wakanda to the rest of the world is, you know, considered to be a developing nation. And, you know, no one knows that it's actually this very high tech and advanced civilization. So when they're flying over, you know, the outer part of Wakanda and then, you know, go through some sort of camouflage they have. And the effect of them going through that camouflage and then entering like the real Wakanda and then just getting that view of the city and the city set in that, you know, African wilderness. It just looks really awesome and definitely a highlight of the film. So beyond just how good the movie looked, the strongest part of this film is it's definitely just the story and the theme. You know, the first thing that came to my mind is just, we get this look into how a country, you know, how its people and its culture can thrive when it doesn't have to overcome, you know, the fallout of colonialism. That's kind of the first thing that struck me. And then we see this clashing of the African-American culture that's represented by Killmonger. And then the traditional Wakandan culture is represented by T'Challa. So that, you know, really plays a role in the film. I think that's also the heart of the film as well. And it just brings up this question of, you know, Wakanda continuing to stay in the shadows, you know, living in comfort while the world is filled with this injustice against, you know, Black people. And then it creates this main conflict in the story, and all of that just plays really nice together. And, you know, even though this is a Marvel film and set in the MCU, it doesn't feel like other Marvel films. Most MCU films all have that similar look, similar feel. And this one just definitely, it just doesn't feel the same. There's just so much that's unique about it that we've just never seen in any other Marvel film. And they don't spend half the movie setting up other movies to come, which was really nice to see. There's barely any, if any, reference to other films. There's one or two here or there, but they're pretty subtle, and it's pretty easy to miss them, I think, if you don't know the rest of the movies really well. I think I missed a couple that I ended up reading about later. So I think definitely with all the other Marvel movies, they're spending so much time setting up upcoming films that takes away from the main story of what they're trying to, you know, cover in the main movie. But this one, you know, it knows it's a Marvel film, has little bits here and there, but that's not their focus to set up other films. The focus here is the story, and that definitely makes a huge difference. I wish other Marvel films would continue down that path. So, I mean, we do, Civil War obviously plays a role with this film because that's where we're introduced to T'Challa and Black Panther, and so the events that happen at the beginning of Civil War play out here as well, where T'Challa's father is killed in Vienna during the Sokovia Accord. So that part is here, but we don't see any of the characters from Civil War in Black Panther for that part, other than T'Chaka, which is T'Challa's father. And then, yeah, we have a couple characters from the MCU here. We have Martin Freeman from Civil War, who comes back in his role as the CIA agent. And then we have Andy Serkis from Age of Ultron as Claw. So they return, but there's no one else. None of the Avengers show up like any of the other films. So I think lots of the other films always have one of the main Avengers in it to kind of, you know, to ground the movie and to, you know, give you something to tie it back to everything, and just, you know, it has these characters in it to, I guess, kind of bolster it up a little bit, but that's just not here. And there's definitely opportunity for them to mention these other characters or events, but they just don't. And yeah, I just like that it's a self-contained film, doesn't rely on having to know the entire story of the MCU. It's just a film unto its own, existing within that universe. And I think that's one of the stronger parts of this movie. And I think Marvel should take notes from this movie and continue that with, you know, their future movies. So this film has a lot of women characters in it, and they're all pretty awesome. I really liked how T'Challa's security force is made up entirely of women. I like how his sister Shuri, played by Letitia Wright, she has a lot of humor into this film as well. This movie isn't super funny or anything, but there's definitely bits of it there. And I think Letitia Wright, you know, is probably adds a lot of the comedic relief here. And she's really great as the head of technology for Wakanda. And she's, you know, she's very charismatic. She's presented to us like Q from James Bond. And there's even this, you know, there's a scene in this film that's basically the classic scene that we see in every James Bond movie. And we see Shuri walking T'Challa through her workshop, showing him all the new tech that she's come up with and the new gadgets that he's going to be using. So it's straight out of a Bond movie. And I think that was, you know, that's pretty cool. And then, yeah, her character and her as an actor, I think, yeah, she's pretty interesting. And I really look forward to seeing, I think she's going to be in Ready Player One, and she's in Avengers Infinity War. So I look forward to seeing her in those films. Just all of these female characters, they're there, and they're all given agency, and everyone is just treated as equal. There's just no inkling of any type of, you know, gender inequality there. It's just, they're just another character, and there's nothing there that makes it obvious that these are women in roles that usually we don't see women in films. So I think that was a nice touch as well. Chadwick Boseman, he's pretty strong as the Black Panther and as T'Challa. And we were introduced to him in Captain America Civil War. And I really liked him in that movie. And he continues to, you know, be just as good here in the Black Panther movie. Just does a really nice job of portraying a man that's just carrying the weight of his country on his shoulders. You know, the weight of trying to, you know, continue taking Wakanda down the path that his father and previous leaders took the country. And then we see his arc as he's, you know, we see him trying to break out of that shell when he realizes that it's, you know, it's not his obligation to follow down their path, but to maybe go down one that makes sense for Wakanda in today's world. And that's basically, you know, his theme throughout this film. And I think Chadwick Boseman, you know, he really sells it here. And then we got Michael B. Jordan as Killmonger, and he is so good. The motivation behind his actions is believable and very easy to understand why he's doing what he's doing. And it's, you know, it's very easy to find yourself agreeing with a lot of what he is saying and what he is wanting to do. The film does a really, you know, good job of just creating that conflict in the audience, and you find yourself sympathizing with him. And I think that can be attested a lot to how the character was written and just the history we get of that character. And then Michael B. Jordan, I think just him as an actor and the way he takes on this role, I think he actually steals a lot of the scenes he's in, or every scene he's in, even the ones with Chadwick Boseman. And it's not that, you know, Boseman was weak or, you know, bad at anything he did. Like I said, I thought he was really good. But I think when Michael B. Jordan's on screen with him, and the fact that maybe, I don't know, the charisma that Jordan has, maybe, you know, that plays off a little bit as well. But even just Killmonger and his character just seemed more interesting than T'Challa, even though T'Challa, I think, is also a strong character. But I think Killmonger, like many villains, is usually the more interesting character in a story. And so I think Michael B. Jordan here is, you know, the star of the show. Not the star, but he is the one people are going to probably be talking about. And I don't know, I don't think that's a bad thing. I think it doesn't deter from the movie or the strength of the movie at all. I think it just adds to how good it could, how good it is. So his character, Killmonger, Eric Killmonger, I think he's easily the best villain we've seen in any of the MCU films, and probably in any superhero film I can think of. He's not evil for the sake of being evil. You know, he's not evil because the script is just saying he's evil. He's actually a fully thought out character who seems to be like a real person, and he's not like a cartoon character twirling his mustache. He has actual motivations for what he's doing, and, you know, people watching can, you know, they sympathize with what he's gone through and why he's trying to do what he's trying to do. So I think that makes for a strong, strong villain. And that's usually the problem with most superhero films lately, is the villains are just weak. And, you know, you usually get these, an anonymous group of aliens just wanting to destroy the humans or the Earth or whatever for some reason. Or you get, you know, a giant beam of light that shoots up into the sky that people have to stop. Or the villain is just uninteresting. Yeah, Killmonger is none of those things, and you actually want to see more of him. And you actually remember him when the movie is over. So lots of good stuff in this movie, lots of stuff to like, but there's definitely some stuff that I didn't think were too hot. Like, I think the action in this movie is probably the weakest part of the film. So I was hoping that, you know, from the fight perspective, I thought we were going to see a lot of, you know, I was hoping to see kind of what we saw Coogler do in Creed. I just think back to that first fight that Adonis Creed had in Creed, where he's, you know, in the ring, and we get that continuous tracking shot for the whole fight for 2 minutes, I think. And, you know, that shot just puts you in there right in the middle of the fight with Adonis. And, you know, that scene is memorable, and everything about that continuous shot, you know, lots of times continuous shots are put in and they just seem like they're there for the sake of it. But in Creed, that particular scene and sequence, you know, that continuous shot played a role in how you watched that scene, and it made, you know, it played a role in how you felt about that scene. And I was really hoping we were going to get similar type of stuff here. So we get a similar scene in Black Panther where we get this continuous shot. It's in a casino, And I think it's probably the best fight scene in the film. It happens pretty early on. But it is a continuous shot. I'm not sure how long it was. Maybe a minute. But it just didn't hit me the same way as that one did in Creed. So, I mean, it does a good job of just letting, you know, you as a viewer know where everything is going on in the environment. There's all these fights going on between the main characters and then, you know, these guys that are fighting in this casino. So it really, you know, captures that, the environment and, you know, where these things are happening in relation to each other. And it also, you know, really does, you know, it helps to, you know, with the lack of cuts, it lets you fully realize that all this action is happening at once. So, you know, you're on the Black Panther fighting one guy, and in the middle of the fight, the camera, you know, pans away into another area where his security, main security officer, she's fighting another person, and you know that that other fight is still going on, right? There's no cuts, so you know all this, you know the way it all fits together. So it does do a good job of that, but it just didn't seem to have the same oomph that we saw in Creed. And then there's, you know, like, so there's a couple fights in Wakanda that are set in water near this waterfall, just one-on-one fights. And I thought those were going to be really solid as well once they started to play out. But I don't know, there's just, there were, a lot of it was really close-up shots of the fight and lots of fast cuts. So it just made it hard for me to, you know, really follow the action or understand what was going on. So that was a bit disappointing. And then there was some bad green screen effects, I think. And it was always around the backgrounds. It was like you knew that the characters were in front of a giant green screen, you know, for the entire background. So I don't know what the reason for that was. I was actually pretty surprised that it was so noticeable. I don't know if it had to do with a 3D or what, but it was definitely noticeable to me. And when those scenes came up, it even though the backgrounds were really gorgeous, it still pulled me out because you knew that the characters were against this green screen, and that's disappointing. And then as much as I like Michael B. Jordan's character, I would like to have seen more of him. There was a stretch of the film where I actually forgot about him, and, you know, they got away from him for a while, and then he just showed up again, and I was like, oh yeah, he's awesome. And like, why aren't they showing me more of this guy? So, I mean, yeah, the action for me was disappointing, but I think that, despite that, I mean, I don't think that's what's, even though it is a Black Panther and a superhero movie, I don't think the action was the drawing point for this movie. I think just the story and the story they're telling and, you know, just the representation that we're seeing here for everyone. I think that's that importance there. I mean, you know, seeing different type of people on screen than what we're used to seeing. I think that plays a pretty huge role in film today, and it's easy to overlook that and, you know, not think about it. But when you do see that, you know, you then realize that, you know, that this is missing once you actually see it. It's missing from movies we see in general. So in the movie theater we were at, it was the Saturday night, and it was sold out, I presume. I think it was a packed house. And so where I'm from is, I mean, in Canada here in Saskatchewan, which is mostly a rural province. It is mostly a white population. And usually if you go to a movie, it's usually, you know, mostly white people. And so it was interesting for this Black Panther showing we saw. I mean, it was the similar type of people. It was mostly white people and, you know, like myself and, you know, a few other minorities, you know, sprinkled throughout. But there are, in this particular showing, there was, you know, I think there was four couples I noticed sprinkled throughout the movie theater. Four Black couples, older, I think. Most of them were a little bit older. And they were dressed up in, you know, some sort of traditional outfit. You know, the women had on colorful tops and some colorful headscarves. And then the men were also dressed up in some traditional piece of clothing as well. So I thought that was pretty awesome to see that. So, I mean, I don't know, maybe those couples go to the movies every weekend. I don't know, but my assumption was that, you know, that they don't. Maybe that's not a safe assumption, but my assumption was that they don't, and they were at this because, you know, they got to actually see a film that they typically would never get to see, or they don't get to see made. So I thought that was pretty cool to see, and that was, you know, that just helps to, or that just, you know, shows the importance of representation on the screen, and, you know, letting people should be able to go to a movie and see people that look like them. And I think that's really, really important. And I think this film did an awesome job of doing that. And it's pretty cool to see Marvel, you know, take that step and actually put the huge money into this film and go for it. And it's obviously paying off. I mean, its opening weekend was huge. Fifth biggest ever, I think, opening. So obviously a success, and hopefully we see more movies like this in the future. So overall, despite, you know, not having the level of quality of action I'd expect from a Marvel film, the story, the unique vision of Wakanda, and just the fact that this film has something relevant to say makes it very easy to recommend. My rating for Black Panther is 4 out of 5. So that's all the films I watched for this week. Next week, I'm planning to watch 3 more films. 2003's 13, directed by Catherine Hardwicke. This will be my 8th film in the 52 Films Directed by Women project. 2018's Annihilation, which opens next Friday, the 23rd. This is the new Alex Garland film starring Natalie Portman. And then, also opening February 23rd, but opening on Netflix, 2018's Mute. So this is the Netflix film directed by Duncan Jones. So that's the plan for next week. So if you want to try and watch those 3 movies, or, you know, some of those movies, so you can follow along with the reviews, that'd be great. So that's it for episode 11 of the Red 7 MovieCast. You can find more episodes of this podcast at red7cast.com. You can subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and TuneIn Radio. And you could really help me out if you gave me a review and or a rating on these services, especially iTunes. A review or rating there would be great. And you can find more of me on Twitter and on Letterboxd at HJNaidu. That's HJNAIDU. And until next time, just keep watching movies. Bye.